Hello, and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's program, I am honored to have as my guest, Dean Clancy. Dean is an expert in federal health and budget policy, a member of the Board of Scholars of the Compact for America Educational Foundation, a consultant, analyst, and opinion writer on U.S. healthcare, budget, and entitlement policy. And he is a strong supporter of the Balanced Budget Compact here in North Carolina, which is Bill HB 366. He is a former senior official in the White House, Congress, and the healthcare industry. He has served as a legislative advisor to the U.S. House Majority Leader from 1995 to 2001, on the Senate staff of the Congressional Joint Economic Committee from 2009 to 2010, staff director of the President's Council on Bioethics from 2001 to 2004, and was a top White House budget official on healthcare and entitlements from 2004 to 2006. Dean also has extensive private sector of experience, which includes successful tours as vice president of a multinational, multi-billion-dollar medical device manufacturing company and vice president of the 6-million-member FreedomWorks, where he coordinated the group's policy and political action. Dean is visiting us here in North Carolina to work on getting the HB 366 bill passed. He is also a founder of Adams Old LLC, a Washington, D.C.-based consultancy that helps clients advance the cause of civil rights, individual liberty, and constitutionally limited government. Dean, thanks for being on the program today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And we're just excited here in North Carolina to learn more about HB 366, the Compact Initiative, and just everything that you can enlighten us with today. So let's start with, what is the Compact for America, and why is it important to North Carolina?
Sure. The Compact for America is a national effort in which the states would secure a federal constitutional amendment requiring Congress to balance its budget with strict enforcement mechanisms. And it's led by the states. So there are bills in many states, including here in North Carolina. You mentioned the bill, HB 366, which is has been introduced by Representative Chris Millis. And the bill would basically join North Carolina to the growing movement of states who want this particular balanced budget amendment added to the U.S. Constitution. And by passing this bill, North Carolina would take the lead, if you will, and join the movement for a federal balanced budget.
So the federal balanced budget, it's about us understanding how big our national debt is growing and why, and it's about why we don't currently have a balanced budget at the federal level. So can you kind of expand on that topic?
Oh, sure. Our nation is in debt, as you know. Everyone knows about the national debt. It's approaching $19 trillion. To put that in perspective, our entire economy in a year right now produces about $17 trillion. So if you thought of that like your own salary or your own annual income, imagine owing personal debt, like credit card debt, you know, well in excess, 105-110% of your annual income. And, you know, nations that build up that much debt get into trouble, as we've seen in Greece and Cyprus and other countries, and eventually they have to do something to deal with that excessive debt. And it can be very painful. So, and by the way, we have debts on top of our national debt. We have unfunded liabilities, promises the government has made to retirees, for example, under Social Security and Medicare, the Medicaid program, and other large federal programs. These are promises that have not been provided for. There's no funding actually provided for to keep the promises. If you add those sort of unofficial debts to the picture, then we're up over $100 trillion in debt, and by some ways of measuring it, $200 trillion in debt. Well, there's no way we can pay that.
And if we're thinking about it from that size, of you said our national economy is $17 trillion right now. That means if every
nickel, dime, penny, dollar of anybody earning was taxed, we still wouldn't pay off the national debt this year. So if everything we did went towards that, we're still in debt. Not only that this year, but that 10 years from now, we still wouldn't have it paid off if everything we did and produced went towards paying it down, right?
That's right. We have to change our policies. We're not going to pay off the national debt in a year. It would crater the economy, destroy everyone's standard of living. It'll take years to get the debt under control by reducing spending and growing the economy. And then it will take decades of discipline to basically reform those big programs where we've made promises that we just simply can't afford to keep. And so it's, you know, fixing the debt is a long-term process. The problem now is that we haven't even begun. We haven't committed ourselves to getting our federal debt under control. And that's what the Compact for America Balanced Budget Amendment is trying to do.
And so it's begun to look like we need a constitutional amendment because the government just isn't willing to self-police and do it themselves, basically, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Congress isn't doing its job. Its job is to balance the budget. Yes, it may have to borrow from time to time. For example, you know, if you need to fight World War II, you're going to have to borrow. But then you need to pay that back. And in the past, our government always paid the money back very quickly after a war or major emergency. But since the 1960s, Washington hasn't been doing that. They've just been piling the debt up, up, up. It always goes up, never down. And so there's something structural going on. And you need a structural reform to deal with a structural problem. And that's why we think that a constitutional amendment that would control the debt and incentivize Congress to reduce spending is really the best way to go and a necessary way.
So if a constitutional amendment was passed, could Congress ignore it?
Well, that's a great question, because you're right. Washington does ignore some parts of the Constitution.
Just a few.
No, I think the way that you ensure that they don't ignore the constitutional amendment is that you put in incentives so that they assent. Basically, they want to follow the amendment, and there's penalties if they don't. So, for example, in the balanced budget amendment that would become part of the Constitution, if the Compact for America were adopted by at least 38 states, and by the way, we have 4 states that have adopted it. We're just at the beginning. We're hoping North Carolina will be the 5th state. But if you get 38 states and then it becomes part of the Constitution, what that amendment says is Congress has a limit on the amount of debt it can maintain. It can borrow underneath that limit, but if it tries to go above that limit, it has to get the approval of a majority of the states. This would be a major change, because right now nobody sort of looks over Congress. There's no board of directors, no co-signers on the loans. Congress is policing itself and not doing a good job. Under this amendment, the states would be policing Congress. They would get to say yes or no to an increase in the national debt above that fixed limit that would be in the Constitution. So if there were an emergency, the states could say, sure, you can borrow money, you know, as long as you pay it back in a certain time, for example. But, you know, just borrowing just for the fun of it, you're not going to be able to do that anymore. And by the way, the amendment has another enforcement element. It basically says the president can automatically cut spending when we get close to the debt ceiling. So in order to prevent us from going above that level, he can do automatic cuts. And if Congress doesn't like those cuts, it can substitute different cuts that reach the same target, the same amount of savings. So that and the president would be subject to impeachment. I mean, he could be impeached. He would be vulnerable to it if he failed to do his duty and keep spending below the debt limit. So those are enforcement mechanisms that would ensure that Congress doesn't ignore this amendment to the Constitution.
So I have to ask, given all of the dynamics we currently have in our government, so we have the executive branch, we have the judicial branch, and we have the legislative branch, which are supposed to keep each other in balance. Is there a role for the judicial branch in enforcement if Congress and the president don't step up to the plate and do what they're supposed to do. If Congress doesn't hold the president's feet to the fire, the president doesn't hold their feet to the fire. Is there a judicial route there of also of saying this automatically goes to the Supreme Court or something to deal with this?
Well, that's an important question, because you're right. You know, under our system of separation of powers, you have three branches, and they check and balance each other. In the compact balanced budget amendment, we do not give the Supreme Court power to enforce the budget. And the reason is because the experience in the states, you know, a lot of the states have their own balanced budget amendment.
Right.
And they've gotten into trouble where the judges, the local judges, have ordered tax increases to balance the budget. And so our view is you don't want unelected judges getting involved in borrowing, spending, debt, those kinds of questions. Instead of referring it to the courts, we, in a sense, refer it to the states. The state legislatures become that check and balance on Washington if it spends and borrows too much.
So how much, you know, grassroots support does this have around the country? I know my friends and I talk about it. I'm all behind it, or you wouldn't be on the show. But how much really grassroots out there is there talking about it? I see a few news shows that do some, you know, talk about it, but it's not a big buzz right now. And so what can we do to get more people aware of it, to grow that grassroots support and really get that messaging out here in North Carolina and around the country?
Well, there is a lot of grassroots support for balancing the federal budget. It polls extremely well, and it always has. And there's majority support, strong majorities support a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution that is enforceable and can actually bring about a balanced budget. At least 60% of Americans consistently say they want that amendment. Why doesn't it happen? Well, it's not for lack of public support. It's because the folks in Washington are content with the status quo. They like being able to spend and borrow and put the costs of spending on future generations.
Right, they're buying and selling based on how they get to spend, how they get to allocate money, how the IRS works, all of those kind of things is the power. So the government has become a self-sustaining organization or organism even that's defending itself by not putting a balanced budget amendment in there.
That's exactly right. Washington does not want to balance the budget. That would be bad for business from their perspective.
Their business, our business.
Yeah, exactly. It would be great for taxpayers. But what they do is they play a game. They say, we support a balanced budget amendment, and then they hold a vote on it every few years, and it's a symbolic vote. What they do is they will get a majority in the House and Senate, but because it requires two-thirds of the House and the Senate to pass it and send it to the states for ratification, you know, under the Constitution,
right,
you have to have a two-thirds majority to propose an amendment, they always come a little bit short. Sometimes it's one vote short in the Senate, for example. And usually that one vote is somebody who claimed to be for the idea, but then, because he's not up for re-election this time around, votes no to make sure that Washington gets its way and the budget is not balanced.
Well, and we look
so they're playing that game.
Yeah, we look at that dynamic, and because it is a get reelected mode, so often the people we send there that say, we're going to balance the budget, we're going to put this control in, or that, there's no accountability because 6 years later you vote for them to go back in, or 2 years or 4 years, and a lot of things happen. So they start I call it the Scarlett O'Hara effect, you know, tomorrow's another day, we'll deal with it tomorrow. And tomorrow is here, right?
That's it. We have to deal with it now.
So how does this actual compact process work? If North Carolina passes it, another state, we need 38 states, and then what happens?
Well, if we get 38 states, and we do need Congress to kind of give its blessing to this, the Constitution requires that if you're going by way of an interstate compact. But luckily, you don't need those two-thirds majorities we were talking about. When you go by compact, you only need simple majorities, which is much easier to get. And, by the way, you don't have to present the bill to the president. So there's no, you know, veto by President Obama or what have you. Basically, this compact process is led by the states, and it's a way to get around the obstacle in Washington. Assuming you have majorities in Congress that really do want to balance the budget, and basically the way it works is when the 38 states have passed it and Congress has passed a resolution blessing what the states are doing, then certain things happen automatically. One is that you have a convention of the states to propose the amendment. This is required by Article 5 of the Constitution. Some people call it an Article 5 convention. And under this proposal, that convention would be pro forma. It would actually not be a debating convention or a drafting convention because the balanced budget amendment would already be drafted. It's in fact already drafted. It's in the compact document that everybody would sign off on in advance.
And can we see that? Can we see that language on one of the websites?
Oh yes, yes. If you go to compactforamerica.org, you can see the actual text of the balanced budget amendment that's being proposed.
So we don't have to pass it and then see it. We get to see it now before it gets passed.
Yeah, it's not like Obamacare. You don't have to pass it to find out what's in it. It's all up front. And this convention that would be triggered, as I say, is pro forma because all the rules would be decided in advance. Those two are in the compact. But who is the chairman? How many delegates? How the voting takes place? All of that is already spelled out in the compact. And the reason for all that specificity is because a lot of folks have a legitimate concern that if we had an Article 5 convention of the states to propose constitutional amendments, that convention might get off track, that it might run away and just, I don't know, try to propose a whole new constitution or something crazy like that.
Or throw in a few term limits and things like that too, right?
Yeah, I mean, right. The point is people are concerned that the convention wouldn't limit itself to the subjects that everyone agreed in advance it should talk about. And so what the compact does is it prevents that. It avoids a runaway convention because a compact is an agreement between states. It's like a treaty, you know, between countries. It's a legally binding document. It's basically a state law, and if Congress blesses it, it's also a federal law. And that means that you can go into court. And so if that convention, you know, if all the delegates got drunk and started doing something that wasn't provided for in the compact, then an attorney general from any of the member states could just walk into a court and say, I need an injunction to stop these guys. And by the way, the compact itself says if they do anything other than what's in this compact, everything they do is legally null and void from the start as if it never happened. So we've taken every precaution we can think of to make sure that convention really is just a formality, that the amendment that's in the text, what you see, is what you get. And we just need 38 states to say, yes, we like that amendment. We want that in the Constitution. That would shift some power back to the states. It would put some accountability on Washington. And we want the majorities in Congress to say, yes, we like that amendment, and we're willing to let the states take the lead on this one because we don't trust ourselves here in Washington to write the amendment ourselves. So if all those things happen, then we will have the amendment. And by the way, the compact has a little timing or a fuse in it. It basically says 7 years. Sometime in the year 2021, that fuse will burn out. And basically the compact expires. And if we don't have 38 states and Congress's blessing by that date, then it just goes away. And we'd have to start over with another compact, another project.
So we have this Article 5 convention that's spelled out in how it happens. So we get the 38th state. How many days after that 38th state says yes does that actual convention convene?
It needs to take place, I want to say, within 60 days. And I have to double-check the language. Yeah. It certainly has to take place within 1 year of Congress blessing the process. If it doesn't take place, then the whole thing expires.
So we have 38 states that sign on, hopefully all 50, but let's just go with the 38. The 38th one signs on, it goes to Congress, they do the resolution, then the convention happens, everything executes, and we have an amendment?
Yes, because Congress's resolution basically says, states, if you do all these things and only these things, then we already agree in advance this basically goes to you for ratification. The states, in their compact, are saying, Congress, if we do all these things, then we will have the convention, we'll vote on the amendment, and they do have to have that convention and vote. They got to vote up or down. If they vote it up, then all the other steps are triggered automatically, and it becomes part of the Constitution. It's a very simplified system, so that basically what you have is every legislature and Congress have just one bill to pass, one vote to take, basically, and then they're done. They just wait and see if everybody else, you know, joins in.
So here in North Carolina, our bill is HB 366. It's been making its way through the system, and right now it is setting where and what do we need them to do for the next step.
The bill has passed the Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives, and now it is pending before the Appropriations Committee because there's a teeny little amount of money, about $3,000, that would need to be spent basically to, you know, pay for the airline and hotel.
For the convention,
For the people to go to the convention and do the up or down vote. By the way, the convention would be a 24-hour gathering. It has to take place within 24 hours. Or it's not legally valid. So it's very simplified. Anyway, they need to pass that $3,000 appropriation. And then the bill could go to the full House. And assuming it passes there, it would go over to the Senate. And our hope is that all this will happen and will happen within the next week or so before the legislature adjourns for the year. They're working on their budget right now, as you know. They're coming to closure on that, it looks like. So we've got a couple of weeks window here to get the bill through the Appropriations Committee, the full House, and the Senate. And we're looking for help, you know, from folks around the state who are interested in this issue to call and email and put in a good word for HB 366.
And so they can go to the NC Legislature website and get the Appropriations Committee information, get Representative Millis's information, and reach out with email, do it through your Twitter accounts and all those kind of things to let everybody know where you stand and what we want North Carolina to do. This is a state-by-state thing, but it is a national initiative. So how is this playing out in the other states that are out there, and you know what's going on? Who's next? How can we help with that next step, too?
Sure. As I mentioned, the compact has passed in four states. Those states are Georgia, North Dakota, Mississippi, and Alaska. They have formed an interstate commission, which is a standing body with representatives from each of the member states whose job is basically to keep all track of all the records and, you know, who approved and to basically oversee the convention when and if it occurs. And so we're looking for the fifth state. There's only about three legislatures in the country that are currently still meeting and have a chance to vote on this issue. Those are North Carolina, Michigan, and Ohio. So compact supporters are working quite hard in all three of those states to try to pass the compact legislation there. And then we'll have another round of states' legislatures getting together starting in January. North Carolina doesn't come back, I think, until May for the short session. So if we don't get HB 366 passed in August, we're going to have to wait all the way until next May to complete the process. But basically what folks should do is come to the compactforamerica.org website and get more information. You know, sign up for the email updates so you get notified, and let us know what state you're in, and we'll send you information about what's happening in your state.
Well, now, we're talking about this bill and the amendment, but let's talk about the realities of what a balanced budget does and how it impacts our economy, how it impacts our businesses, you know, how it impacts healthcare. I mean, the balanced budget and the need for it, you know, has ripple effects for our economy. We see it in Greece. We've seen it in Cyprus. We see it in Puerto Rico. So can we kind of talk about how that $19 trillion debt is impacting everything right now and kind of translate that into why we need to act now?
Yeah, absolutely. I tell my kids, avoid debt. Debt is the plague. And it really is, because it cripples you. You become, in a sense, a slave to the person you owe the money to. We all need a little bit of debt, you know, from time to time. We borrow for a house or a car. Businesses need debt to grow. Governments need debt, you know, to fight wars and so on. But But in general, debt is a bad thing. In fact, I have five little rules that I try to, you know, remember, my fiscal rules of common sense. And they are limit spending, tax lightly, borrow the minimum, maintain a surplus, and pay down debt. And the way you pay down debt, ultimately, is you run surplus. You always basically spend less than you earn, than you take in. And that's
right.
True for governments as well as for individuals. So our governments, particularly in Washington, don't follow those rules. In fact, they do the opposite of all five of those rules. And that's how we know that we're in trouble. We're headed in the wrong direction, and we got to change something. What does it mean for the economy? Well, when you have too much debt in a nation, that basically the government then is spending a lot of money on interest payments, which then crowds out other parts of the budget. Also, the government is going into the bond markets to borrow money, and that can crowd out the others, you know, the private sector businesses that are trying to borrow for their purposes, and that can drive up the interest rates, which drives up the costs, first for the government and then ultimately for everybody in the economy. So basically, it's like a tax on everyone. Debt is like a tax, and it's burdening the economy. You don't get as much economic growth as you would without the debt. And so that means more people out of work. That means we're producing less, lower standard of living. Debt really is at the root of all of those problems. And so that's why it's so important to balance the budget. It's not just, you know, about the budget. It's about the economy and our prosperity and jobs and our standard of living.
Well, and when we start looking at those interest payments, I mean, they're so large that, you know, they're not going to making our obligations to Social Security payments, to Medicare, to Medicaid, to those things, those promises that have been made. Without that debt, there's more money to do roads projects. There's more money to do all these things. But isn't it also about the priorities that we're setting? And so if we think education is important, we need to make sure those education systems get the right dollars, but every dollar is spent wisely, right? Isn't it also a connection to the values, and the debt mode sort of reflects the values of the country?
Yeah, absolutely. A budget is a statement of values and priorities. It reflects who we are as a society. If our budget is mostly going to, or a large chunk of it is going to, basically just servicing a massive debt, we're basically saying we're going to mortgage our kids' future because we want to live a little higher now. We want to buy more battleships. We want to pay for more spending programs, more welfare programs, and so on. But we don't want to pay for them now. We want to put that burden on a future generation. And that really, I think, is immoral. And that's why you want to run modest surpluses all the time, except in an emergency, so that when you really do need to borrow and change priorities quickly, you can do that, but you haven't bound yourself by all this immoral debt you piled on your kids and grandkids.
Well, and we call it a mortgage. A lot of times that's the language we choose, but it's indentured servitude, isn't it? Because a mortgage says, I bought a house, hopefully, within my income means, or I've done something that it's a timing difference. I know my income is going to increase over time, so I'll be able to make this payment and still have money to live on and still have money to save. That was always the mentality. But what we have now says, okay, we're going to let everyone get into this borrow and spend mode. So we have growing credit card debt. We have growing student loan debt. We have all of these different things that are out there that we've taught this model. And everyone's going to wake up one day and realize we're working, you know, half the year for the government to pay the interest payment. We're working another couple months to do this. Our education,
right.
We have less options for education because we have to borrow. And then we realize, well, I can't pay that back if you're borrowing six figures or more and you end up not getting a job. 30% unemployment in the African-American community in the 18 to 20-somethings. You know, we have all of these different symptoms that are there that are coming from this spend mode where we need to pull back and say, what are our values? What are the most important things? How can we keep our promises today, tomorrow, and in the future? And I don't see us having that true underlying discussion. It wants to become a bipartisan thing, but the value is, and the reality is, this has been happening from the 60s. That's both parties.
Right. Yes, that's right. It's a bipartisan problem, and it is a problem of values. We're basically saying, sorry, we're just not going to be able to do all the things that we think are important now, because in the past we burdened ourselves. And it's true that it's affected the whole culture, and we've encouraged too much student loan debt, and we've had housing bubbles where people basically take on mortgage debt that they can't really afford, and we've encouraged that through bad public policy, and so people get hurt. You know, they end up having to walk away from their house and have a terrible credit record for years. The student loan debt, I think a lot of people are thinking, wow, you know what, I might as well just pile up on student loan debt, because the government is never going to make me pay all that back. There's going to be a kind of forgiveness at some point, and it's like I got a free education, which is a terrible way for people to be thinking. The whole point of education is that you learn how to do something that's going to earn you an income and make you a self-supporting citizen. And instead, the student loan system encourages you to think, hey, maybe I could just kind of have a free ride on the taxpayer.
Well, and you look at that, because all those years ago, 30 years ago when I was an undergrad, a student loan was for your books. It was for your dorm room. It was for the things, the tuition. It was the things you had to have. And unfortunately, we see people, at least I have actually seen firsthand people that use it for a vacation. They use it for a car. Because, and it's like, okay, that, and then they flunk out of school and they wonder, well, I can't pay it back. And it's like, what were you thinking to borrow $50,000 for a $5,000, you know, program, tech program or whatever? And no, you're not going to get a job. You didn't do the education. You didn't put in the effort. You didn't do that. But yes, you have $50,000 with the debt, and you're surprised that the government's knocking on your door. Or a private source that they got the student loan from is knocking on their door. And so this mentality of it, there's something tomorrow, the money will show up, or I won't have to pay it. There's always bankruptcy, or there's always these kind of things. I think that's begun to pervade our system, and it's coming as much from the government as it, or more so from the government, the example there as to what we used to have and think of as normal values. We bought one house, we paid the mortgage. There was a mortgage burning party whenever, you know, you paid off that mortgage. And now it's, you talk to realtors, and I remember buying my house. And they said, well, in 2 years when you're ready to buy another house. And I thought, why would I be ready to buy another house in 2 years? And it's that kind of the next thing, and everything just keeps running, and we don't want it to catch up with us. And if we keep running faster, it won't catch up. But the reality is, right, a Hurricane Katrina, a 9/11, a series of small terrorist attacks, something attacking our electric grid, all of these things can make such a hiccup in our economy that we don't have the reserves now to pull on. If we had a balanced budget, we had that reserve, we had that stash, right, then we wouldn't be at that mercy of an economic downturn every time something happened.
Yeah, you make a good point. If I could just go back to the balanced budget amendment in the compact for a minute, it actually basically creates a line of credit for Congress. You know, that debt ceiling becomes the limit. If Congress pays down the debt, then it has headroom, you know, a ceiling that it can work up to in terms of borrowing when there's an emergency. And as we said, if it's a real emergency, they can go to the states and ask permission to exceed the limit temporarily. And so you want Congress to have a line of credit. In fact, everybody should have a line of credit, but it should be an amount that they can manage, that they can afford. It's not too much, not too little. And the compact EBA, I think, strikes a real nice balance on that. And also, one other thing that you were talking about, how we tend to, you know, borrow and buy a new house and overconsume. And one of the reasons for that is our tax system. You know, when you tax something, you get less of it. And if you don't tax it or subsidize it, you get more of it. And our tax system taxes production. It taxes work and effort, savings and investment. That means we're taxing the jobs and wealth creation of the future. What we should be taxing instead is consumption. In other words, when you actually go out and buy something, that's when you should be paying a tax. If we did that, that would encourage people to save more, invest more, and that would create pools of money that would be used to generate new businesses, new jobs, and more wealth in the future. We don't do that. We tax production and incomes. One of the nice things about the balanced budget amendment in the Compact for America is that it would encourage Congress to gradually shift away from taxing incomes to taxing consumption. And the way it does that is it basically says you can't increase current income taxes or the payroll tax except with a two-thirds majority in each house. Currently, it's a simple majority. So this would be a higher bar for tax hikes. But if you want to start shifting the burden to a sales tax or a, what we used before the income tax, which was imposts and duties, or we also call them excises and tariffs, those are consumption taxes, you can do that with a simple majority in each house. So I hope you see how basically we would be shifting the playing field so that Congress over time would tend to move towards consumption taxes and not income taxes. That would be really good for our economy.
Well, because the consumption tax is something that we can tend to control. If I want to buy a car and pay the amount of tax on it, if I want to buy a house and it's taxed, whatever those transactions are, I can make the decision if that's an exchange that's worth it. As a person, right. Generating income, going out there, getting that education, going into debt, paying it off, getting a good job, and then getting out there, it almost becomes a disincentive when you sit down and say, well, what is the number? I don't know it is now. Let's say it's $100,000. Well, you notice when you go from $30,000 to $100,000, but you don't notice when you go to $200,000. The next number is when you're making $1 million. Reality is most of us won't make $1 million and see that jump. But we do get to say, if I'm making $45,000 and I have two kids and I have a reasonable mortgage and I'm making it, my wife works, my husband works, whatever we're doing, then we can sit down and say, okay, we can consume this much, and by consuming that much, that means we're paying this much in taxes. We control that.
Right.
We're in charge of our own destiny. If we need to borrow, again, we know how much we're borrowing and how much that consumption is going to cost us. And we don't see that in our current system. And we are also, again, Congress has held onto those strings because, again, it's a power thing. The IRS, nobody wants the IRS to knock on their door. And I don't think anybody would stand up and say, oh, yeah, I trust the IRS. They are here to help me. We're eliminating that fear, that intimidation tactic, that discrimination tactic in some instances of the government deciding who will pay what and who won't. This person's $6 million in the hole in back taxes. This person's $6,000. I'll go after the $6,000 because the person with a $6 million in arrears is somebody politically connected. That goes away if you're consuming. Everybody consumes and everybody pays when they make the purchase.
Right. That's exactly right. Consumption taxes leave the consumer in control because you can buy less or you can substitute products where, one product might have a lower tax than another under a consumption system like a sales tax system. So that's exactly right. And one thing I would add to that, consumption taxes also put a limit on government because if the government imposes a tax on a good or service that is too high, people will stop buying that thing because the cost will be embedded in the price of that thing. So basically there's a kind of natural pushback that the market will give to the government saying basically you're taxing this product too high, that's why we're not buying it. And so it's like a price signaling system for the politicians, and it will help spread out those costs and rationalize them so that, taxes might be a little higher on the goods that, people really want to buy no matter what, like, say, whiskey or something.
The luxury goods, right?
Yeah, luxury goods, exactly. And they'll be lower on things that everybody can substitute easily. Maybe you could substitute different kinds of food from one that has the tax to one that doesn't. Or maybe you could also go to a different, if you live on a state line and the state next door has a lower sales tax than your state, then obviously you're going to do a lot of shopping across the state line, and that's going to send a signal, too, to your state that maybe they should lower their sales tax rates.
Well, I know I've lived in 11 states, and watching how the sales and use taxes apply in each state, some states, normal foods, milk, bread, the basics, no taxes at all. Certain types of clothing for back to school and things, no taxes at all. And again, like if we could, like Minnesota was one of the states I lived in, what was taxed in Minnesota at a low rate or at no cost, people would come in from the other states to buy, like you were saying. Or if there was something cheaper in Wisconsin and you were making a major purchase, they would go over there and make the purchase. And there were things between the states that said you couldn't go to one state and buy the car and come back and not have paid the state when you transfer it in, those kind of things. But there are ways each state dealt with that. And it's kind of, again, the competition between the states to decide what is it the people are willing to pay, what's affordable, and how are they going to spend based on those choices.
Right. Right, exactly. So that's, again, you know, one of the nice things about the Compact for America balanced budget is that it includes a provision on taxation that's designed, first of all, to keep Congress from trying to balance the budget simply by raising taxes. That would be economically harmful. What we need is for Congress to find ways to rein back spending, cut out the waste, the duplication, the programs that cannot be justified either, you know, legally or in terms of their necessity or their effectiveness. And by focusing on spending, you get a much better economic benefit from balancing the budget. But at the same time, the provision encourages Congress to move towards consumption taxes away from income taxes, although Congress wouldn't have to do that, but it would become easier for Congress to make that shift, and that would be economically really good for everybody. And like you said, it would give people more control over how much they pay in taxes.
So this, the Article 5 convention happens, and it's just for this balanced budget cycle. It doesn't stay in existence for the next thing we might want to go through a compact system to do, right?
Right. The compact is basically a template. In fact, I like to think of it as a launch vehicle, and the balanced budget amendment part of it is sort of like, you know, the payload on the launch vehicle. So we could deliver a balanced budget amendment using an interstate compact. We could use a term limits amendment by an interstate compact or whatever amendment we want to do, as long as you can get the 38 states and the Congress to sign off.
At some point, do you think if we have, and I'm praying hard that we're having success with this and it happens, but once we see the success of the process with the balanced budget amendment and then we move on and we see it, could you foresee each state creating an easier process to make it less burdensome for the compact system to work through their legislators and things?
Oh, yeah. I think you would see a renaissance of the states in our system if this compact actually succeeds for two reasons. First, the compact balanced budget amendment itself gives the states more power to oversee Washington's spending addiction, makes the states the co-signers on future loans. But the second, and in some ways the more exciting way that this model will make the states sort of revive in their power and their, you know, legislative skills, is that now they will have a pathway to making needed constitutional changes that doesn't require going through Washington. They won't have to get that two-thirds majority in House and Senate. They will have an alternate route they can use. And the benefit of that is Washington will wake up and realize, oh, no, if we don't do our jobs, the states can amend the Constitution again and take away more of our power and impose more accountability on us, so we better do our job. And so, yes, I think you'll see the states basically focusing more on the compact model as a way to propose constitutional reforms. You'll have the states talking to each other more through the interstate compact commissions that are set up under these kinds of proposals. And all of that, I think, is very much in the spirit of the founders, who really saw our system as based on the people, but with the states as the next most important element in the system. And the three branches of the federal government are really at the bottom of the ladder. They're our servants. They perform certain national functions, very important, but they are not our masters. And the states, if anything, the states are the masters in the system, with the people, of course, as the true sovereign or master above all. And the compact model, I think, helps to get us back to that spirit of federalism and state control.
That of the people, by the people, and for the people that I've heard of before?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and we look at balancing this the voter, the citizen, having that vote and getting out and being active in the voting process and selecting the state legislatures, the government system at the state and local levels. And then originally the states held the government, the federal government, accountable. The federal government only had the rights the states awarded. So how great that we can actually go back to our roots of where every citizen's vote counted, and we want that to be an educated vote, and all of these different processes that we have to bring it back to where you and I, we the people, actually can say we don't agree with what Congress is doing. We go to our state legislature and get that compact commission that's in our state activate and saying term limits. It's time for that. You know, and each state could, in effect, before this 7-year period for the balanced budget starts, start another action to start the compact for term limits, correct?
Sure. You could use this model for any kind of constitutional reform you can think of. And it's already pre-written. It's a document of about 10 pages in length. It's very, you know, it's lawyer's language. It's designed to be very precise and very protective of, you know, the Constitution and the prerogatives of the states. But it's a template. It's almost like, you know, how you can get a will or, a license document off the Internet, you know, and you just fill in the blanks with your name and so on. Well, same thing with the compact constitutional amendment model. You just take it from this proposal, you insert your constitutional amendment and change the dates and put it out there and see if you can get other states to approve it and Congress to bless it.
And so that's something we need to be, again, being active in our communities, in our states, and being aware at a federal level what is happening and how we want to take back control and make sure that our values at our local level is reflected at the state level, and then the federal government is held to accountable to those values. And I think this is a good place to start. We have about six right. minutes left, so let's go back over real quick those five little values you had and then give us some insight into really how we can help this move along. We have a couple of weeks to get this done in North Carolina, and we really want to get it done.
Okay, sure. Those five rules of fiscal common sense that I mentioned are limit spending, tax lightly, borrow the minimum, maintain a surplus, and pay down debt. And those are the goals of the Compact for America with its balanced budget amendment that's embedded in the agreement. The Compact is an interstate agreement, and it's designed to basically automatically lead to a federal balanced budget amendment as long as 38 states pass the bill and Congress passes a resolution in the House and the Senate blessing it. There's no presidential involvement, no veto possible. And when those things happen, we will have a balanced budget amendment that requires Congress to limit spending and stay below a debt ceiling that is enforced by the states and by the president, making cuts if we get near that ceiling, with Congress substituting different cuts if it wants, as long as it stays below the ceiling, and with Congress also having the ability to shift our tax system to a consumption-based tax system instead of income taxes, if it wants to do that, but not being able to just balance the budget with tax hikes. So all of that is embedded in this one proposal, which, as you mentioned, is pending here in North Carolina. We got a couple of weeks. HB 366 is the bill number. We need folks to help us pass it. If we get it passed, it will be big news because very few states are in session right now, and it will give momentum to the national movement to get this compact passed in 38 states. So, you know, what can people do? Well, they should sign up for the email alerts at compactforamerica.org so they can stay informed. They should go to the North Carolina Legislature website, which I guess is ncleg.net, and look at the Appropriations Committee. The chairman of that is a fellow named Representative Nelson Dollar. I love that name, Chairman Dollar of the Appropriations Committee. And basically send him a message please schedule the bill, HB 366, so we can get it through the House and Senate before the North Carolina legislature adjourns this summer.
And I'll put on my focusresourcesinc.com website their information. So if everybody wants to go there and look under Focus on Business and today's program for email addresses, phone numbers, and things like that, I'll put those out there this afternoon after the show. And I don't think we can overstate how important the shift back to state-controlled government and states' rights and our individual rights is to how our country is going to proceed. And basically, our country is becoming an indentured servant to those we're borrowing from.
Right.
When I think of what things else that are changing in our government and how things are being approached, what is the impact then on trade agreements and things on when we have a balanced budget? That may be a question out of left field, but we see some of the Republican presidential candidates talking about canceling trade agreements or not signing off on this and shifting things. How does this come into play and how does it impact our $19 trillion debt and our economy going forward?
That's an interesting question. Obviously, yes, our national debt is held primarily by foreigners, or at least a large chunk of it is. A lot of it is held by people in China, for example. And so if they should decide to dump their U.S. Treasury bonds, try to sell them, that will have severe negative economic consequences on the United States, because suddenly it will be harder for our government to borrow to pay for its bills, and that'll drive up interest rates that will hurt the economy, hurt Americans. So having less debt held by foreigners is a great benefit of balancing the budget, maintaining surpluses, and paying down debt. And so the other part of that question is trade and trade agreements. Now, obviously, Americans are of different minds about how far free trade should go, and how protectionist we should be. My own personal opinion is I'm very favorable to free trade, but I don't think that it should be, crazy. I think that we have national security interests and economic interests that we have to consider when we have trade agreements with other countries. But if those countries had less of our debt in their portfolios, they would have less leverage over us in those trade negotiations. So is that where you were going with your question?
Yes, it was. And I mean, right now we've seen China recently devalue their currency, and that has ripple effects on the value of what people will buy from the United States because of that difference in currency. Our exports become more expensive. Their imports become less expensive. And so free trade only works when everything is truly free. So finding right. that balance between how the United States does business completely open versus how China does business, again, we don't have as much freedom to make sure things are going fairly if we're in debt to countries we're afraid to tick off because we want to react back to their arbitrary devaluation of their currency. And so right. we see that reflected in our stock markets. We see that when Cyprus happened, we've seen it with Greece. This is a very connected world, and the health and strength of the United States often depends on how healthy our economy is and how independent we are financially from those around the world.
Amen. Yeah, it's important not to be dependent on others. You use that term indentured servitude. That's really what debt does. It turns you into a servant to others, and that's why we got to control the debt and balance the budget, and that's why we need a constitutional reform to bring that about, and that's why we want the Compact for America balanced budget.
So everyone should visit compactforamerica.org. They can reach you where, Dean?
Sure. You can reach me through that website, or I can even give you my email address, which
okay,
is dean.clancy@compactforamerica.org.
And you can also follow him on Twitter at Dean Clancy. And I want to thank you for being on the show today, Dean, and for joining us at such short notice yesterday. And if there's any way we can help, you know where we're at.
Well, you're helping a great deal, and I've really enjoyed the conversation.
All right, thank you. And everyone, until next week, stay focused on the important things.